Okay, the topic that I have either been given or selected is Preaching Christ Old Testament, and we are having four sessions on this, and so it's something that will develop step by step this entire conference. We'll do it three mornings, and then the last afternoon, I suppose Thursday afternoon, I also have a session where we'll try to wrap this up. And then I have a small group, I think, that meets on the book of Exodus later in the day. Is that right? Okay, good. Well, I am happy to talk with you about this because one of the things I am hoping we will do today is to set If you've studied piano or some other musical instrument, teachers at the very beginning will insist that you do certain things, like scales, for example. I have a 15-year-old and a 6-year-old grandchild who are learning how to play piano. And so, you know, the thing they hate the most is, why does my thumb have to go over there? Why do I have to do it this way? Why can't I just do it any way I want to? And the reason they want that so much is because when they see experienced people play piano, they notice that they tend to just sort of do what looks like it's very natural. That's because when you first start teaching people how to do things, you want to give them a methodology that's rather mechanical and that they can put into the machine and grind away, and out comes the right product every single time. Grind away, out comes the right product every time. And I'm assuming that you are here in large part because most of you are novices at this. Nod your head, please. Good. Thank you very much. So I would assume also then that as you've been taught about preaching, and especially preaching about from the Old Testament, and especially this popular topic of preaching Christ from the Old Testament, that you have probably been given a very mechanical, play these scales, throw your thumb under there, as you're supposed to, approach to doing this, which is perfectly fine. But as life goes on, I'm hoping that you will learn to play the piano a little more, with a little more improvisation, a little more creativity, a little more freedom. And what I hope to do is to open the doors for that kind of freedom even this week. You may not get it. You may not even care about it. In fact, you may be confused by it, but that's okay. You can think about it in the future, and perhaps it will actually give you opportunity as you're looking at true parishioners who have real needs, and you're trying to meet their needs rather than the requirements of a teacher like me. Those are two very different things. Okay. In our day, it's quite popular to speak of preaching from the Old Testament in at least two different ways. One of them made it into the title in your brochure, the other did not. The first way, one way, is to say we should preach Christ from the Old Testament. And the other way is to say we should preach the gospel every time we preach from the Old Testament. In fact, there are people who would say every time you preach anything from the Bible, you must preach these two things. And sometimes they mix them together, sometimes they keep them separate. But Christ and the gospel are certainly important in the Christian faith and certainly ought to be part of what we do when we preach from the Bible. And I'm all for that and all happy for that. But what I've discovered as I hear the proponents of these views, many of whom come from my country, you know the books, I'm not going to refer to the books. All I have to do is give you the topic, you know the books immediately, you know the people immediately. But something I've noticed about them is this, that when I hear them preach, they don't practice what they preach. They don't do it like they tell other people to do it. It's the funniest thing. Because as they actually preach Christ and preach the gospel and preach other sorts of things, they do it in ways that don't quite comply with the methodologies that they would then give to you. And the reality then is that the reason for this is because if you can imagine, lots of these people are quite accomplished as theologians and as Bible scholars. If you think of their whole system as if it were a gigantic iceberg, actually, what you get in a book is about the 20% that floats above the water. There's an 80% of what they believe and what they understand and what they're competent to do that never surfaces as you read their books. It's beneath the surface. And it's that 80%, as you can imagine, is very important. Leonardo DiCaprio learned that that was very important, didn't he, in the Titanic? He was on the original, wasn't he? Well, all I know is it went on and on and on and on. Okay, remember the theme song? Okay. Well, he found out that the 80% below the water is extremely important. Otherwise, if you ignore it and just think that the top that's floating above the surface of the water is what's important, then basically the Titanic sinks. That's you. That's your ministry. And so what I find is that the 80% beneath the water is something that controls, restrains, feeds into, gives color to, embellishes the 20% that you read in the books that they give you. But then I discover something else, and that is that the students of such people who write these books about preaching Christ and preaching the gospel every time you preach, what students tend to do is to slice off the 20% and float that in the water. Now, if you slice off the 20% and you float that in the water, how much continues to be above the surface? I'm told by mathematicians about 4 to 5%. Now, when you're taking 4 to 5% of what these people have as 100%, now you have only a thin veneer of what they're offering you, and a thin veneer of what the Bible offers, and a thin veneer for what your people need from you as preachers of the gospel. So what I'm hoping to do today is not really to contradict what the things that are in books, if we can keep in mind that they're the 20%, but rather to take the 20% that you usually find in pamphlets or books or articles by people who talk about preaching Christ and preaching the gospel, and point to the 80% beneath the water, so that you can perhaps read those books and those articles in the light of this 80% that's submerged, that they'd never bring up, but which controls them and enhances what they say so very much. In reality, the plethora of books and articles that have been written in recent decades on preaching Christ or preaching the gospel from the Old Testament are in response to what has been perceived of as a problem that they are addressing, a problem that they have seen either in themselves early on or they have seen in others, especially in decades past. And sometimes these problems are put forth in very sophisticated ways, sometimes not such sophisticated ways, but there is a problem. And what I want us to do today is to more or less address the problem that these kinds of books and these kinds of articles, these approaches of Christ and the gospel every time you preach, what is the problem they're addressing? Because if we can identify the problem, then maybe we can see their solutions in a better light, and maybe we can find a way to point to the 80% that they don't bring up when they write about these things. What we're going to do is several different things. We're going to talk about the fact that these people and these articles and the people who endorse these approaches at large are dealing with what we might call some popular strategies on preaching. Some popular strategy. In other words, the thing you would find in a normal, average evangelical church anywhere in the world, including your own country here. Then I'm going to speak of the Christocentric solution. There's one of the solutions that they have for the problem that they see in the popular strategies. Another is the gospel solution. In other words, preaching Christ or preaching the gospel, and we'll try to figure out what those things mean when people talk about them that way, and then what we might want to say about that. And then I'm going to introduce the proposal that I'm going to give you this week. Now, you can imagine letter D is going to be embellished upon and elaborated upon in all of the other talks we're going to have this week. So don't expect much today. Just expect an introduction to the problem, and I'm going to encourage you to ask the question, has he gotten it right? Is this the problem that people are trying to address when they talk about preaching Christ or preaching the gospel from the Old Testament? So let's talk first then about the popular strategies that give rise to these solutions. If we were to think of these popular strategies, I suppose as I look at it, I find two things that are often conflated, but two things that I think are actually in many respects different from each other. The first one would go something like this. Of course, you start with the Old Testament. And then what people do as they preach from the Old Testament is one of two things. And we can characterize the first approach in this way. They go to the Old Testament, make a selection of something that's there that they want to preach on that Sunday. And you know the normal course for this is that you are trying to read the Bible every day, I hope. And so you read until you come across something that you think you can preach, and that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so you select that piece out of it, and you take it, and that's wonderful, and that's a fine way to go about preaching, as a matter of fact, in my opinion. And in general terms, what many pastors do in their congregations is they will discover in some Old Testament passage, whatever it may be, wherever it may be, some theological fact that they think is interesting, that they think is usable, that is able to be applied to their Christian audiences. What we tend to do, of course, the nice way to put that is we go through a book, say, like Genesis or Habakkuk or Nahum, which I'm sure you've preached from Nahum many times, or how about Zephaniah? That's a good one, isn't it? What we tend to do is go through these books and take gleanings from these books, and that's what I'm talking about, which basically means you go through and read till, oh, I can use that. Ooh, I can use that. And often what those things are theological facts. This, of course, is the basic approach of traditional systematic theology. If you think about it, and it's often disconcerting when you read something like the Westminster Confession of Faith and you look at the proof text that they have, or if you look at a traditional systematic theology and you look at the verses to which they refer, and if they're Old Testament verses, you sometimes have to cock your head like a dog and go, well, I guess that verse does talk about God. And I guess we are sort of talking about God here, so maybe it is relevant. And you tend to give them the benefit of the doubt, especially if it's something as wondrous as the Westminster standards. So you say, okay, they must know something about this verse I don't know. But what they're doing, basically, is they're looking at these passages in the Old Testament, and they're drawing theological facts out of them. They may be things like these. God is powerful. Simply as that. It's as simple as that. Or God is merciful, as simple as that. Or that God judges people who are sinners. Or that God is very kind to people who try hard, shall we say. That God listens to the prayers of his people. You name it, there are thousands upon thousands of theological facts that would naturally, normally, be of interest to us. And Christians will often select those facts, and then they will ask the question, what relevance does this have for the Christian church? Fine. Not only is that a long-standing approach to the Bible, it's something that you will inevitably do. You may have been told over and over and over again, don't do this, but I can guarantee you within a year or two of preaching, week after week after week, this is exactly what you will do if you're brave enough to venture into the Old Testament at all. How about that? Did he actually say that? Which is why you probably won't venture into the Old Testament very much. Okay. There is another approach that parallels this that I think gives rise to the difficulty, another popular approach that is out there and that we all recognize, and we've actually heard this one probably spoken of more negatively even than the first, and that is that as you read the Old Testament, you discover not more or less theological facts, not data, things that are claims about God or claims about humanity or claims about the creation or claims about angels or claims about whatever it may be, but rather you read the Old Testament and you find what we hate so much about the Old Testament, and that is that it has so many moral obligations in it. Say amen, somebody. I mean, how many rules are there? You know, the rabbis say some 630-some. Depends on which rabbi you're talking to. Ask three rabbis, you'll get four opinions. That's in the Talmud, you know. Okay. But there are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands upon thousands, of passages in the Old Testament that provide us with moral obligations. Things like, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Things like, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Things like, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Things like, do not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, that's a good one for cheeseburgers, isn't it? You run the risk, don't you? Every time you eat a cheeseburger, you run the risk of boiling a kid in its mother's milk. You realize that, don't you? Okay. Don't trim your beard. Whoops. So on and so on, the list of obligations go. And the reality is that there are so many of these that as you selectively glean from the Old Testament, you can stumble across one that has some relevance for your life and for the lives of the people in your church. And it's really not all that hard to do. Because what you'll tend to do, of course, is to ignore the things that don't quite fit into what is conventional Christian ethics. Yes or no? Okay, and then you'll highlight the things, of course, that do fit well with conventional Christian ethics. Conventional defined in terms of the ethos of your own local congregation and what they will accept and what they won't accept. Okay. Now, if we go the factual route and if we go the moral route, then certain results occur usually in preaching. And when this occurs, then this is the result that the popular books out there on these subjects of preaching Christ and preaching the gospel, this is what they're against, the results of this. And that is not the lack of application from the Old Testament facts, the theological claims of the Old Testament, but more or less atomistic approaches to this. In other words, you're reading along and you discover that God hears the prayers of the weary, the weak, those who cry out. And you can then use that fact that God hears the prayers of the weak and the weary and those who cry out, and you can preach your whole sermon about that and not connect it to anything else in the Bible. Now, of course, you know you'll be doing that in the background of your own head and your own heart, and you're hoping they'll do that too, but you only have 20 minutes. So as you elaborate upon this theological fact, more or less focusing on this set, small set of facts, you will tend to treat it atomistically. The same might be true if you're thinking in terms of a particular commandment in the Bible. You shall not kill. Then the tendency would be that we'll make a statement of fact about that, and then we'll relate that fact to the people and treat it atomistically. Now, the response to this is going to be quite compelling to many of us, because we will discover that this is where the solution is presented, that what we need to do when we preach the Old Testament is to preach Christocentrically or preach Christologically. That's the answer to this atomistic application of biblical facts or theological facts from the Old Testament. On the other side, however, and this is the one that was always we should boo and hiss when we hear this, that when you come across moral obligations in the Old Testament, ooh, now this is very bad, because we certainly don't want to ever do this. We will offer our people and our churches moralistic, which you know is a very negative pejorative term, moralistic lessons. In other words, we'll tell them they ought to do this and they ought not do that. Now, if you're familiar with these kinds of books, then you know the locus classicus for this is always, the one that people tend always to refer to, is David killing Goliath. Say, yes, I know that. Okay? And when they deal with David killing Goliath, then this is the approach that they scoff and they mock and they say is the most ridiculous thing a person could possibly imagine as being the purpose of the story of David killing Goliath. And that is that David stood up to the giant of his day, and you should too. David believed in God, and you ought to as well. David fought against evil, and you should too. And they say, why would you ever want to do that? That's just moralistic preaching. In fact, they could do that in the synagogues, the accusation is made. What's Christian about that? And so we all shudder at the thought that we might actually end up telling anyone, anytime, what they ought to do or ought not to do. For fear that we'll fall into this, I don't know what it is, Judaizer trap of moralistic preaching. Of course, I always wonder, you know, the response to this that these people bring is, what we need to do, of course, is to realize that David is a type of Christ or a foreshadow of Christ, and therefore this story really is about Jesus and those kinds of things. You've heard this before, yes? Say yes, please. Good, good. So I'm not speaking here in the dark. Of course, my response to that is always, well, anyone who's worthy of being your king or worthy of being your Messiah is worthy of being imitated. Imagine that. Imagine that we are to imitate Christ, who is the fulfillment of David's line. And when it did the right thing, Jesus did the right thing much like that. And yet we don't look at Jesus and say, well, objectify that, keep that away, don't ever be moralistic about Jesus' life. And we should not do the same with figures in the Old Testament either. So we are at a crossroads here, because in many respects the rhetoric against atomistic interpretation and moralistic interpretation or application of the Bible often leaves young ministers especially feeling hampered and feeling empty-handed when they read the Bible, because we almost naturally tend to do that. And we fight against it, and the only way to really fight against that, I suppose, is to come up with a methodology that will be mechanical and will be rigorous, that can keep us from falling into these traps. Well, I'm going to offer a different approach. An approach that I hope will actually set you free to be somewhat atomistic when it's appropriate. Ooh. And be careful to be concerned about morality when it's appropriate. Now the question, of course, is, when is it appropriate? And the answer to that is going to be twofold: when the Bible leads you that way, and when your people lead you that way. Okay, that's what the problem is. That I think that these people who write these books and proclaim these messages of preaching Christ and preaching the gospel, these are the problems that they are fighting against. It's the problem of atomistic use of theological facts and moral applications, moralistic applications to people from the Bible. So now the question then is, what are their solutions to these problems? In many respects, we're going to look now at one problem, one side of this problem, and the resolution to that, or the solution to that, that's offered to us so very often, and then we'll go to the other side and see if that's the case. But before we do that, rather than me continuing just to talk to you, I want to ask you, do you have any questions about the way I've identified these two problems that are being addressed in these books and in the literature and by people who speak in these ways? Have any issues you want to say? Come on, you can do it. It's your chance. You don't have to wait till the end. How many of you have heard that you should avoid moralistic preaching? Good, good job. How many of you have heard the sort of thing I've mentioned here as sort of atomistic, thematic approaches to the Old Testament, that you shouldn't do that either? You should never major on minors. I mean, okay, good. If you've heard these things before, then you know that they must be talking about something that's been detrimental. And it can be detrimental to follow these two paths. But I also want to suggest to you, it can be detrimental to avoid them without the proper approaches as well. So the first solution that people offer to us is the Christocentric solution. And the Christocentric solution is brought to us in response to more or less the atomistic approach, the factual atomistic approach to Old Testament texts. And of course, the passage in the Bible that you hear constantly referred to as people think about this is Luke chapter 24. Okay, so let's take a look and see what happens in Luke 24. This is the road to Emmaus. And if you've read any of these books or heard any of these articles or heard anyone speak on this topic, this is the passage. Here it goes. And Jesus said to them, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ would suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Now, you know how this passage is normally used. There are certain assumptions that are derived from it and then become the hallmarks of this Christocentric approach to Old Testament texts. The first thing that people derive from this is, for some reason, I don't know where they get this out of this passage, but they get it nevertheless, that what Jesus did here is normative for what people are to do every single time they pick up a Bible. That's the first assumption. That what Jesus does in this passage is normative for what people are to do who love Jesus every single time they pick up a Bible, which being interpreted means that your number one task, the norm that Jesus establishes for you, the hermeneutical model that he provides for you, is that what you're supposed to do is find him in the Old Testament. Anything short of that is to fall short of the norm of biblical interpretation that Jesus himself espoused. Now, that sounds nice, doesn't it? I mean, after all, Jesus apparently did do something like that. He showed them where he was in the Old Testament, beginning with Moses and then going through the whole thing. He said, here, look at this, think about this, think about this, think about this. So wouldn't it be nice to do what Jesus did here? And the answer, of course, is yes. He is the Lord, not just of our moral lives and our daily lives, but he's also the Lord of our hermeneutic. So yes, it would be wonderful to imitate what Jesus does here. The difficulty with this is that this is not the only passage in the Bible where Jesus handles the Old Testament. Cha-cha. And in other parts of the Bible, other parts of the New Testament where we see Jesus or his apostles and prophets who are authorized by him to handle the Old Testament in certain ways, we discover that they are not constantly, consistently, and without any variation, always referring to Old Testament passages and say, you see, this is where you see Jesus. You see, this is where you see Jesus. You see, this is where you see Jesus. Or in the case of Jesus himself, this is where you see me. 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 So while what Jesus does here is normative for us, it is not exhaustive of what Jesus himself did, nor his apostles, nor his prophets. And for that reason, the norms that the New Testament give us, and they are our norms because the only infallible interpreter of Scripture is Scripture itself, are not regulated exclusively by this particular passage, whatever Jesus does here. So if you become mononoetic in your approach to Old Testament passages, thinking that your task as a faithful follower of Jesus is to do what Jesus did in Luke chapter 24, then let me remind you that Jesus has this thing called the Sermon on the Mount, where he deals with the Old Testament quite a bit, and he doesn't constantly remind people, you see, can you see me there? Can you see me there? Can you see me there? He actually says bizarre things like, I know what the law says. You shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that if you look upon a woman with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery. I didn't hear him saying that. No, do you see me in that verse? When the apostles treat the Old Testament, they do similar things. They will draw all kinds of lessons and applications out of the Old Testament that do not have specific and direct reference to Jesus himself. So the first difficulty that we should all face when we deal with Luke chapter 24 and treat Jesus as the norm here is that this is not the only passage where Jesus performs biblical interpretation, and therefore, when we collect this encyclopedia of how to interpret the Bible, the methodologies that we should follow and the goals that we should have, it must be broadened to include other places where Jesus, his apostles, and prophets deal with the Old Testament also. Are you with me on that? I don't know why people don't say this, but they don't. They read this passage and they act like that's the only place Jesus ever read the Bible. Okay, that's the first thing, the first problem with this passage. Second problem with this passage, as it's used against atomistic preaching and in favor of Christocentric preaching, is that we're given the impression that what Jesus did here was not refer to how the Old Testament anticipated him here and here and here and here in the law and in the prophets and in the writings or the Psalms as they're referred to here. Not that he did it. Well, you know, remember that verse? Or do you remember that passage? Or do you remember that passage? But rather, that Jesus somehow took the time. This is the impression people have when they hear people speak about this, that Jesus took the time actually to go through nearly every single page of the Old Testament, saying to them, look, here is a narrative. You've got to see me in it. Let me tell you how. Here's the next narrative. Here's a law, you see me? Here's a prophecy, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, down the road, you see me, you see me, you see me, you see me. Every single line of every psalm, every law, every narrative, every poem, every wisdom saying must somehow have been in Jesus' mind, maybe even on his lips, while he's talking to the men on the road to Emmaus. Quite a long road, actually, I guess. Must have taken quite a while to have done that, huh? But that's the impression you have, and the impression you get from people who talk about this as the model for how we are to have Christocentric preaching is that, therefore, because Jesus did this in all of the scriptures, and by that they mean every single one of them, that's what you must do. There's quite a difference, you know, between saying all of the scriptures, todo de las escrituras, as opposed to every single scripture, cada escritura. Okay, quite a bit of difference between saying in all of the Bible or in every single passage in the Bible. And what does this passage tell us that Jesus did? In all of the scriptures. And then it specifies the three main genre of the Tanakh, the Torah, the prophets, and then the writings are here, the Psalms. This passage does not imply by any means that Jesus was performing here the immeasurable, infinite task of bringing out how he is revealed in every single piece of the Old Testament. But it's the impression that such people who have Christocentric preaching on the brain, it is the impression they give you that if you have dealt with a portion of the Old Testament and you have not shown people how Jesus is present in that passage, then somehow you have failed to live up to the norm that Jesus has given us here. And as a result, there has grown in our circles what I tend to call leprechaun Christology. Now, if we were in Ireland, you would understand this better, okay? But do you know that the goal of having leprechauns running around is that if you catch one, what do you get? A pot of gold. That's right. So Jesus is like the hidden, hiding leprechaun. And if you can find him in this passage, behind this rock, behind this tree, in this bird, or you know, back in that corner, then you get the pot of gold. And you get to tell your people that you have the pot of gold. Now, of course, when they look at the same passage you're finding the pot of gold from, they don't see it, but you have to convince them that that is true whether they see it or not. My older brother tormented me as a young child. He was 5 years older than me, and this is what he would always do. He would say, "Hey, Rich, don't look, but right over there, Santa Claus. He's right over there, Santa Claus." And every time I would look, I'd go like this, and he would say, "Oh, too late." He went away. If you just looked a moment earlier, you would have seen him. And then he'd say, "Now he's over there. Oh, he's gone again." You see, this is what I mean by leprechaun Christology. We want it so badly that we'll look even when it's not there and possibly even imagine him. Because I saw Santa Claus sometimes as a 5- and 6-year-old when my brother told me he was there. I imagined it as such. So, if we were to talk about this and to say, what are these people trying to do, then basically what they want to do is they'll look at the Old Testament, they'll come up with some theological fact or some subset of facts, some perhaps complex set of facts, and then their concern is not to leave it there, but to set these facts on a track, a diachronic track. Because the Old Testament comes before Jesus, and if you're going to find Jesus in these facts of the Old Testament, then of course you must set the Old Testament on a timeline, a diachronic line. And then what you have as your job then is to start with where you are in the Old Testament and then trace this thread, this factual thread that you've discovered, and how it then develops and leads up to none other than facts about Jesus. It's interesting how far people will go with this, because they will actually do things like find Christ in the most peculiar places and think that they have justification for this in writings like Paul when he talks about the rock and things like that. But what they end up doing then is operating, even with the Apostle Paul, with the 20% that's on the surface, above the surface, and not with the 80% that's beneath what he says on the surface. And to know how Paul is dealing with Christological facts in the Old Testament, you have to get into the 80% below his water as well. But this is the problem, and this is the solution that many will offer us. And they will say to us, if you're not finding Jesus in that passage, don't you dare preach it until you do. Which, of course, means by Saturday night, you're putting him in there whether he was there or not. Okay. So now, let's go to the other side of this. The other side is the gospel solution. Now, what we're going to do this week is we're going to talk about Christocentrism and gospel. We're going to elaborate on what these things are and what it might mean to say that we are Christocentric in a more positive way. And we're also going to talk about, in a more elaborate way, what the gospel is, because in many respects, what we have here as the solution is not adequate because the concept of the gospel is not adequate. But let's see if we can make it clear as to what's going on here. You know, Christians, again, believe that the gospel is very important. I certainly do. I hope you do, too. I hope that you believe that the good news about Jesus, about the kingdom of God, those kinds of things that the New Testament refers to, is extremely important, if not central, certainly among the various teachings of the New Testament that are central or prominent and ought to be held up as such in the witness, by the witness of the church, even in worship services, even in preaching. Good news, gospel, is very important. But when you ask the question, what do people mean by this, we will tend as evangelicals to go to passages like Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. You've heard this passage before. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast. Do you remember that the obstacle, the problem that people who are focusing on gospel preaching from the Old Testament, the problem they're dealing with is moralism. Teaching people do's and don'ts, that you ought to do this, you ought not do that. And what we discover as evangelicals today, and this is not just true in my country, but it's true in yours as well, because I listen to you, I know your people, and I've talked with a number of you at different times, is that what you find is that the gospel is something that is quite contrary to do this, don't do that. It's really sort of amazing how we set gospel as something that is, like in this passage, grace. So that the message of grace is seen as the opposite, the mutually exclusive message of the good news of Jesus that is exclusive of do's and don'ts, of things like obedience. Now, that's a bad word for you, even though the New Testament speaks of obedience to the gospel. That's not in our vocabulary, because the vocabulary of neo-evangelicalism today is that the gospel is a message of grace. 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 And if you're going to have some faith, don't worry. You don't have to have too much, because it's all by grace, all by grace, all by grace. It's a free offer. What you have to do is simply believe, and then you will be justified. And if you're justified, then you will be adopted. And God will never love you less than he loves you now. He can never love you more than he loves you now. There can be no variation in your relationship with him, because you are his, and it is 100% by grace. And so the rhetoric goes on and on and on. Have you heard this kind of rhetoric before? Mm-hmm. Well, you can understand that when you identify the good news of Jesus with those kinds of themes exclusively or entirely, then it's very difficult to deal with, well, not just the Old Testament, but even large segments of the New Testament, like the book of Jude, for example, as we heard this morning. I think Jude does mention grace, doesn't it, Dick? Yeah. Did I say mention it? But in this rhetoric, it's the central thing, if not the only thing, that's talked about. So that every notion of moral obligation is something that you want to set aside under the umbrella of grace. And when you come to the Old Testament, my goodness, we all know that there are tons and tons of moral instructions in the Old Testament. Calls for repentance, calls for obedience, calls for wholehearted obedience and love for God. And surely these things then are contrary to the message of grace in the New Testament. Now, I grew up in a church where I had church school, Sunday school teachers who would always say to us, every time we learn these Old Testament stories like Joshua and Jericho, I can remember this, and it was a very dramatic event in my life, where the Sunday school teacher said to us, I still have her in my brain. I can see her right now in my old, nice Southern Baptist church. And she told us about how Joshua and these people were killing all these babies and things, and how horrible that was. And then she looked at us, she put her little manual down, her little lesson book down, and she looked at us, she said, boys and girls, in the Old Testament, God was mean and God was cruel. Aren't you glad he's not that way anymore? And we said, uh-huh. If that's what a mean and cruel God does, you're daggone right we don't want him doing it to us. We want him different. We all want him different. We all want him to be kind and merciful. We all want him to be slow to anger and abounding in mercy. We all want him to relent from sending evil. The problem is, that's not a New Testament theme alone. That comes from the Old Testament. Somehow, this collection of books that we call the Old Testament marries themes of grace and mercy, kindness that lasts forever and ever, with lots and lots and lots of moral obligation in ways that you and I find very difficult to do. And so we drive a wedge between the Old Testament and Christianity, and find ourselves compelled then to take every passage in the Old Testament, sometimes excluding elements, ignoring elements, diminishing, marginalizing them, so that we can focus on the good things, which is the gospel, the gracious mercy of God, the good news that if you come to Jesus, you'll be adopted into his family, the good news that you can never come under judgment again, contra the book of Jude, who draws from the fact that Jesus brought Israel out of Egypt and most of them died in the wilderness, and applies that to the Christian church he's writing to. Oh my. Much like Paul does in 1 Corinthians 10. Oh my. But that's not a nice message we want to give to people today. We want gospel message. What's happened in my own country, I don't know if it's true for you here or not yet, but if you listen to us, this, it will happen to you too, is that what we have done is we have reduced the gospel down to basically psychotherapy. That the goal of gospel preaching is to provide people a path for resolving their conflicts with themselves, with others around them, and with God. If they can find peace with God, then the flow will come, the overflow will reach their relationships with others, and they'll actually feel better about themselves too. So the wonder of being adopted, the wonder of being justified, and never having to think about any of that ever again, certainly not having to think about serious moral obligation, sacrificial living, duty of all things, doesn't even come up. Because, you know, when you talk duty, all that does is make you feel bad. And the last thing you want to do as a Christian is feel bad again. So you know then what happens in this solution. It's basically that the Old Testament is used, yes, you know, sporadically, but nevertheless used, and people come up with obvious moral obligations in the Old Testament, and then what they tend to do, if they cannot just avoid the moral obligation altogether, is then they relate it to the Christian gospel, oops, often by negation. They'll say, yes, in the Old Testament there were these moral obligations, and boys and girls, don't you see how harsh God was back in those days? But now aren't you glad you live in the New Testament where you're set free from such obligations? It's a backhanded way of actually removing the Old Testament from your life And perhaps you can find some positive connections in this regard, especially if you are in the Reformed tradition, because you know somehow the gospel was back there. And so you might find a slither of it here, a portion of it, a modicum of it there. But the main thing in the Old Testament you're going to find is moral obligation, which then, of course, as we know from the second use of the law or the first use of the law, depending on what tradition you're a part of, actually drives you to Jesus to receive grace, to receive justification by mercy. Rather than seeing that as a secondary or accidental use of the law, which is Calvin's approach, we see that as the principal or primary use of the law, which is more Lutheran than it is Calvinistic, and you don't want to go there. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay. So then, if we're going to approach these things this week, you can imagine that I'm going to feel as if I have all the answers to these problems. If you'll just listen to me, I'll fix it all for you. I really don't think that's true. But I do think that what I can hopefully do with you this week is to provide some of the 80% below the water that is actually restraining the people who champion the causes of avoiding atomism, factual atomism, and avoiding moralism. They champion these causes, but the funniest thing that I've always encountered, every time I go to the churches of these guys who preach in churches, is that I hear from them some of the most atomistic theological preaching I've ever heard in my whole life. And I hear from them, especially on Stewardship Sunday. I had the misfortune of going to one of these churches on Stewardship Sunday. Can you believe this? And the whole sermon was the most moralistic, you've got to tithe and God will bless you, or if you don't, he's going to curse you, sermons I've ever heard in my whole life. One that would never come out of my mouth, right out of Malachi. I went, my goodness. That's incredible. Oh yes, and by the way, don't worry if you don't, because you're justified by faith alone, everything's fine. Don't be confused. But 90% of the sermon was, we need you to tithe, God wants you to tithe, you better tithe, if you do, God will bless you. Quid pro quo. Why is it that these pastors and these leaders do this? Why do they do what seems contrary to their writings or to their rhetoric about preaching? It's because of that 80% that's under there. It's because they have theological training that's very sophisticated. They have understanding that's very sophisticated, much more sophisticated than what appears on the surface. I admire them tremendously. Not only for the rhetoric they give, but also for what's beneath the surface on them. And it's that what's beneath the surface, however, that is often hidden from people like you and me. So what I'm going to do is make a proposal that I don't think is contrary at all to what they're actually saying if you add the 80%. Don't float that 20% because you'll only get 4% left. But if you get the 80%, I think my solution to these problems will ring true. And I think if they were here in the room today, the five or six people that I have in mind, if they were in the room today, if we had 10 minutes, just 10 minutes to talk about it, we would agree. My rhetoric is a little strong this first hour, but that's okay. Got to start somewhere, right? But if we had 10 minutes to go back and forth, there wouldn't be any problem. I'm convinced of it because I know many of these guys. And we would not have a difficulty at all. Thy problem is when you take the 20% of what they write and you float that and you end up with 4% and you preach that. That's my problem. Okay, so what am I going to propose as the solution to these difficulties in our day? We'll see. Okay, yeah, it does work after all. Okay. I think that when we approach the Old Testament in the ways that are suggested to us, and as I've reconstructed it, and that is that you find a theological fact or a set of facts in the Old Testament, and then your job as a Christian preacher is to take that set of facts and relate it to Jesus, and that if you can do that, then you've succeeded. When we do that, when that's our approach, I think it's artificially narrow in terms of how you're treating the Old Testament, and I think it's artificially narrow in the way you're treating Jesus. Especially because when you hear people talk about You see this passage and you see this character and what he does here? Well, that reminds us of how Jesus did this. What you discover very often is that the one thing they keep on telling us is being foreshadowed in these passages is just one passage. Always the themes which they bring you. That mention of Jesus. Being traditional as you are, you know, in our tradition that has been emphasized a great deal at the time of the Reformation between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants. Controversy had to do with a thing about Jesus, the natural for you being a part of such, if not the only important thing about Jesus, is that he died for our sins. Well, thanks be to God that in recent decades there have been well-known writers who have said, yes, the death of Jesus is very important, but it's no more important than his resurrection. Somebody like named the Apostle Paul, I think, also said that in the first century. So you get Dick Gaffin writing books like The Centrality of the Resurrection. And you go, what? And Charles Hodge, the Princeton systematic theologian, in his systematic theology, there are some 200 pages on the atonement, 20 pages on the resurrection of Jesus. And it's all having to do with how the resurrection validates the atonement. Often do you hear Old Testament passages related to the ascension of Jesus? Not just to his death, but to his ascension. How often do you hear Old Testament passages related to the incarnation of Jesus? We will even take passages like 1 Corinthians 15, since by man came death, by man comes the resurrection of the dead, and we will take passages like that, that obviously are emphasizing the resurrection, and then our sermons will turn them into passages about the atonement. And how often do we hear Christocentric preaching that takes Old Testament passages and relates them to the resurrection, ascension, and second coming of Jesus? Very seldom. Can you go back in your mind and think about such things? Very seldom. So I think there is an artificiality, first, to the way that the theological facts of the Old Testament are isolated and identified. We always have to do that to some degree, but you can be so artificial that you exclude far too much. And then how we connect that to our Christian faith by focusing on just a narrow band, a piece of who Jesus is to us as the one who died on the cross. Artificially narrow. On the other side, I think that very often what we'll find in the Old Testament is moral obligations, and we will identify what those are, a set of those, and we'll relate them to the Christian gospel, but we will also do this very narrowly. Artificially. In other words, we will act as if somehow in the minds of Old Testament writers, moral obligations that Israel had were divorced from the grace and the mercy of God. That somehow Israel, unlike you and me, were expected to obey God in order to have his favor. And we know, of course, that couldn't be true of us. So the contrast is set up. And the selectivity is there so that you can narrow down what the moral obligation is to the point that you can now bring it into the New Testament in some fashion and baptize it by setting it within the framework of grace, 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 and grace. Not realizing that every moral obligation in the Old Testament was originally set within the framework of God's grace and mercy. Artificially narrow. So what I want to suggest to you is that we can come with a new way and try to elucidate this week. And it would be something like this, that when you think of whatever themes or whatever kinds of items you might identify in the Old Testament, let's say a fact or let's say a moral obligation, since those are the two that we've identified as being most prominent in these discussions, that these facts and these moral obligations that we find in the Old Testament are set within a theological framework. That, believe it or not, the Old Testament has a unified, organically unified theological framework, and that the reason God's mercy and God and the obligations of his people seem somehow in contradiction to each other or in tension with each other is because we don't know the theological framework of the Old Testament. And that the theological facts of the Old Testament are not isolated, but rather are in conjunction with other theological facts that do then help us relate it to the Christian faith. The reason we feel as if these things are isolatable is because we're unaware of the system of Old Testament theology. It's a big task to get that system, but nevertheless, it's there. And we have to know what the Old Testament theological system slash systems are, in order to set these items that we've identified as we take our gleanings from passages in the Old Testament, to set them within their framework to have proper understanding of them. But then on the other end, as we come up to the Christian faith, as we come to preach and to proclaim this word of God to his people today, we do note then that we must also be extremely committed to setting whatever items we have isolated in the Old Testament within the framework, the full framework of New Testament theology. I mentioned, for example, the fact that just like in the Old Testament, moral obligation was set within the framework of God's benevolence and God's mercy and God's grace, that the only way in which people ever met any obligation is exactly the same way you meet obligations today, is by the mercy of God. That this is not something that's new to us. It's more visible and more noticeable, experienced more noticeably, perhaps, but it is not new. And when we understand then the system of the old and the system of the new, we can have the conjunction that we want in preaching. And when we realize then that moral obligations in the New Testament are fulfilled not simply by the death of Jesus, but also by the resurrection of Jesus, who was raised by the Spirit, who now lives in you, so that as Jesus walked in newness of life, you now walk in newness of life. Now the complexities of New Testament theology become rich enough, the complexities of New Testament Christology become complex enough to connect us to the complexities of the Old Testament system. Because without the death of Jesus, without the resurrection of Jesus and the Spirit who has been poured on us through his ascension, we have no hope even with the death of Jesus. Now, of course, as we know, in the Old Testament, there have been, depending on where you begin in your Old Testament, what passage you're selecting, there are all kinds of organic developments in the system that precede the New Testament. So if you begin early in the Old Testament, if you're teaching from Genesis or you're teaching from Leviticus, you're going to find more distance from you as a Christian preacher. So you'll have a whole lot more acknowledgement of organic development that has to take place in your thinking, not in your sermon, please. Leave your homework at home. They don't care. They shouldn't care. Leave your homework at home, but do your homework. And you deal with the later portions of the Old Testament, like Chronicles or some of the later prophets, the distance is much smaller. So you'll find it much easier to go. But in order to know that, you've got to get the prelude of the earlier parts of the Old Testament that lead up to those later parts. But in all events, if we can begin to think systemically, rather than isolating this notion or that notion from others in the Bible, both Old and New Testament faith, then we can find ourselves connected in ways that will be very rich, very good, very wholesome, and will not discourage us and cause us to want either to throw away our Bibles, our Old Testaments, or force them into our conceptions of what the Christian faith may be. That's the goal. The goal is not to ignore the Old Testament, and at the same time, not to force the Old Testament into our preconceived notions of what New Testament theology is. And the only way I know to do that is to recognize and to acknowledge the systemic qualities of Old Testament theology and how they morph organically into New Testament theology as a whole. So in the end, what I'm going to be telling you is, rather than preaching Christocentrically, and rather than always preaching the gospel, what you must preach is Christianly. In an attempt to get you to think more broadly about what that might actually mean. Let me repeat one more time so that you'll understand my attitude toward brothers who may not at first blush seem to be agreeing with me. I think that if you take what the more famous people would say and you look at the 80% of what they say beneath the surface, what they believe, it will be very close to what I'm telling you this week. So I'm not trying to get you to do something weird. I'm just trying to get you to line up with what, in my opinion, sound Christians have done throughout the millennium. Amen. Okay. We have 10 minutes for you to talk to me. So please do. Don't just sit there. I could have done that from that screen right there, okay? So don't. The reason I'm here is for you and me to interact. So, Terry, what do you want to say? Huh? Have any thoughts? I saw a hand. No? Come on, somebody be brave. Thank you very much. Yeah, right. That will be a balancing act. You'll have to decide on case by case. The question is more or less, as I understand it, let me say, I make sure I understand what you're saying. I said, don't preach your homework, leave your homework at home. And the question is, don't you want to equip your people to be able to do these hermeneutical moves that you're making? And the answer is yes, of course you do. But it is a balancing act, isn't it, between teaching people how to do what you're doing or justifying what you're doing methodologically with them, and actually in the same 20 minutes actually giving them life in the moment. I mean, surely learning good hermeneutics is life-giving for people in the church, in the pew. But the reality is that they also need something that will meet them now and bring them into the presence of God now. And so as pastor or as consistent preacher in a church, it becomes your task then as a steward to balance this act out over time, to feed them a little more, perhaps methodologically. But my advice to you is primarily your job is to bring the confrontation of the word into their lives in those moments. Yes? Okay. All right. It's almost time for lunch. Good answer. I'll do that. Maybe I can illustrate that first tomorrow. Would that be okay? Okay, great.
Rich,
yes, sir?
Would this proposal affect how we read the New Testament? Would this have implications for us as well?
To be sure.
What
to be sure, because even every New Testament passage must not be read in isolation from the rest, but it must be read both with the background of Old Testament theological system and with the system that underlies the New Testament. One more word. Yes, sir.
You talk about that of the iceberg.
Yeah.
How we often see the top 20%. How can we best guard ourselves against ignoring the 80%? Is it just being aware that there's more on the surface?
Depending on who the person you're reading is, know what branch of the church they're from. And when you do that, in the case of the people I'm thinking about, these are people in the Reformed tradition. So these people assume the truths of, say, Reformed confessions and things like that, and the history of that, as well as the biblical theological movement of recent history, which is more or less where people think it all began. It's like some people think Christianity began with Billy Graham. Other people think it began with biblical theology in the 1940s. But it didn't. We have a long tradition and a long history that supplies us with the system, the underlying system. And so just recognize that, you know, whatever this person's saying, he's not contradicting that. You know that for sure. Because he's a part of a church that is confessional and affirms that. Thank you very much. I hope you have a good lunch, and I hope to see some of you in my Chronicles section.